Hi, good morning, everyone, and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host in Hiroshima, Japan, joined by the amazing Emily Smith. Thank you so much for joining, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Emily is a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker. You may have seen her beautiful documenting of the 72 microseasons in Japan. That's really been your passion since you came to Japan. You said you were already a forager. You've been there 2 years. How's the weather right now? You're in spring, right?
It's really gorgeous at the moment. I think it's the perfect temperature. Although in the mornings, because we're situated in the mountains, it's a bit chilly. It's a bit nippy, as we say in England. But it isn't too hot yet. The sun has been shining. There's been a bit of April showers, but I think this is the perfect temperature.
That's wonderful. Now, your partner, Felix, is a furniture designer. You're living there together. And I watched your NHK short film about you guys and how you are collaborating with so many other artists. And there's, you know, local, working with locals. We'll talk about your neighbor who has adopted you. But you've really found a nice home there in rural Nara. Is that right?
Yeah. So Felix is a designer of all things. He does furniture, but he also designs pretty much anything. But this area is very famous for Yoshino, cedar and cypress. And so for him to be able to work with those materials and with so many designers, because actually, despite there being a population crisis, as they say, within the village, as there is throughout Japan in the small villages, and within our village, there are quite a few talented woodmakers, designers, artists, potters. So it really is an inspiring place on that front. But for me, I love old people. So Felix and I both have our boxes ticked.
That's fantastic. I love that part where they say, how did you choose to live here? And I think Felix says, we decided within about 30 minutes. And you shared at MinkaCon how the 93-year-old neighbor just embraced you, and was that really for you cemented the idea of living there and becoming like part of her family, right?
Yeah, it was a real shock. So we were visiting the house without the government, and I wasn't really sure whether we should be there. We weren't breaking in, but we were kind of what I would call poking around, something that made me feel a bit uncomfortable. We weren't on the land, but we were just viewing it. And then I saw an old lady approaching, and I was filled with fear. I never want to do anything wrong. Even though I didn't grow up speaking Japanese, my mum is from Japan, so I have inherited quite a lot of Japanese traits. So I don't want any problems ever. So I saw her coming over. I say to Felix, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Then she comes over, and I could not understand her at all. This was 3 years ago. My Japanese was completely rudimentary, far worse than it is now. And she has an incredibly strong dialect. But all I could say in broken Japanese was the equivalent of like, I love wild vegetables and I love mushrooms. And she seemed really excited by this. And then I pointed at the house and was like, in Japanese, this house I live, or something. I didn't even know the future tense, so it was very broken. And she just embraced me. And I think that really was such warmth and kindness and trust. And that's the kind of person that I am. And so even though we couldn't speak the same language, I could see a kindred connection, which drew me to moving to the village even more. And we actually only saw that one house.
That's lovely. And let's talk about the house since you mentioned it. So nobody was living here for 100 years.
Yes.
Is that right? And you've renovated it with natural materials and just full of things that are important to you and Felix. all designed by Felix, is that right?
Yes. So we have two houses. The older house, which was the first house on the land, hadn't been lived in, we think, for around 100 years, but there was a cow living there. So it became an agricultural shed. It was in really poor condition. But I don't think anyone in their right mind would have thought of renovating this building. But Felix could see a vision of a really nice house for us. And so we renovated it. A lot of the material was in bad condition, but the structure is very good, made at a time when materials were high quality and with incredible craftsmanship. So it was important to us to retain the history of the building. So we've kept the original beams exposed, and everything that we have put in the house has actually been designed with the former owners, the former people that lived in this house, which was just one family ever before us. We've collaborated with them. So using windows to frame trees that they've either planted or that have self-seeded that are very significant. So our main big window in our area just by me frames the kaki tree, which is so beautiful. And then we have another window which frames the sakaki, which is the very religiously important tree in Shintoism, which has self-seeded on our little mountain right by our side window. And so everything has been considered, and we've used natural materials that are locally sourced. So it has a really nice feel and an amazing smell. And also all the colors we found in nature. So even the shikui mix that we've put in the bedroom and in our living area, these are all colors that you can find in nature. We went for a green natural tatami and a green tile, which really match the new leaves. So it feels very connected to the landscape. We did not want to come here and feel like we were changing things too much. We wanted this to be a continuation and really kind of taking up from where the previous family were and continuing almost in their honor rather than just starting again.
Yeah, it just looks beautiful, and you've made such good use of the space in many ways. Of course, you as a forager, you've also got your jars of pickles and things going on, your tinctures.
Yes, there. This is all right next to me at the moment. We had our first very tiny, tiny, tiny feel of an earthquake, and I was quite alarmed sitting here and feeling that shelf wobble a tiny bit. We're very lucky that, as far as I know, the earthquake risk is much lower here than in other parts of Japan. But that was a little bit worrying. But yeah, I've got all different things here. This is predominantly food. So lots of things with ume, lots of mushrooms, pickly bits. This is just a small, almost like a showcase. But in the other house, there are many obscure things molding and fermenting in good and bad ways, probably.
That's awesome. How did you become so passionate about foraging and living off of nature, really? Where did you learn it from books, or did you study with someone?
So I grew up in the countryside, and so many of my formative memories are so deeply linked to being in nature. I spent a lot of time alone with my dog and just really connected with nature. I had all sorts of little seasonal things that I would do that I wouldn't even tell anyone about. My parents were a bit hands-off in that regard, amazing parents, but they weren't the kind of parents that were like, oh, what, tell me everything you did today, or let's play together. I was left to my own devices sometimes for long kind of swathes of summer, but I was always reading. And as a very precocious reader, I started reading things that were very connected to the seasons pretty early on. And so I just loved being in nature. My dad was actually what I would call a rudimentary forager, although that term was never used. He loves foraging or scrumping, which is an English term. Scrumping is pretty much, it's not stealing, but it's picking normally fruits is associated with it. So scrumping apples. In England, there are so many fruit trees just off little roads, places where no one ever picks the fruit. No one really knows who it belongs to. So my dad and I would travel around the UK. He collected guitars. So I played a lot of music as a child. And we would go off looking for guitars, and he would always have boxes in the back of his car, and he might spot a damson tree in the distance, or he loves nuts. And so we would drive and he would put me on his shoulders and we would just pick. And so my dad is probably the only person that I've met that has the patience to pick in the way that I do. We both love the picking. And so we're selecting each apple very consciously, and really enjoying the process or the art of picking. And so we also did a little bit of kind of nettle soup, occasional mushroom, few mushroom scares. My mum cooked up some dodgy mushrooms. I had a real privilege in having access to nature as a child. But then we moved to a town when I was 13, and quite a lot of the formative foundation that I had just kind of disappeared. And so I replaced that with teenage drinking and going to gigs, probably boys. And so it was only at the start of COVID, just before COVID had really kicked off. So February 2020, I'd come back from doing some incredibly difficult filming. So my work as a filmmaker, I really focused on human stories, but my niche, which you, once you're in, you're not stuck in, but they need a very specialized person to do these kind of roles. So my niche was really working with institutions or vulnerable people. So I spent a lot of time embedded in homicide departments, going out with police to crimes, documenting missing people, documenting missing and murdered women. And so I had just come back from an incredibly harrowing time in Kansas City, where I had seen some really terrible things and feeling just exhausted by that experience. And so I came back to the UK and COVID started kicking off. I was meant to be doing some filming in a hospital that got cancelled because of COVID. And so I was back at my parents' house as I hadn't got a place to live in London. And so my parents live about an hour and a half outside of London in an area which is called the Garden of England. So even though it's a town, it's actually very beautiful. And kind of as a way to avoid being with my parents all the time, I started walking and really fell in love with hiking. I just happened to get interested in foraging really through chance, without even the real knowledge of foraging as a term. It wasn't something that I consciously did, but I smelled garlic smell, spoke to my dad, and he said, "Oh, well, if you smell garlic, it's probably wild garlic." And I thought, oh, I remember having wild garlic at a fancy restaurant a few times, don't really know what it is, but sure enough I smelt wild garlic, which in other countries they call ramps or ramsons. They're all of a similar species. And I picked some, and I came home and I started looking on the internet, and I realized, well, if you can smell onion, it's an allium, and all alliums are pretty much edible. And so I cooked it, and then that was the beginning of a complete obsession, because I was able to combine my passion for nature, my passion for cooking, and my excitement at experimentation. And so all three of those things just merged, and I became really obsessed.
That's awesome. Let's look at some of the photos of you foraging where you are now in Nara. So we have some bamboo shoot there. You must be seeing bamboo shoot everywhere now. This is the season, right?
Well, where I live, there isn't actually a lot of the correct take or bamboo. So if you can see, you can have a little look actually in the photo. And we have houses along the river. So Higashi Yoshino is famous for beautiful mountain rivers. It's actually a very sacred place to water. But everywhere that isn't along these rivers is pretty much sheer mountain. And those mountains are predominantly sugi, so that's cedar, and cypress, which is, hinoki, which is cypress. So there aren't loads of bamboo groves at all. So it's not something that I see lots of, but I do have a couple of friends that have, bamboo groves. So I can pick it from theirs.
Yeah, I know people who are taking over old houses, and if it has bamboo near it, they say they have to spend like a first year cutting it back. Yeah. And they are happy to give away shoots when they come out because there's more than enough that they can eat, right? So yes.
But
how do you cook it? You saute it a bunch of different ways?
So the process of cooking takenoko, generally, the first thing you do is remove the aku, which means bitterness. And so that's done traditionally with a lot of the sansai, which is the Japanese mountain herbs, which are famous in springtime in Japan. So a typical way that you would remove the aku or the bitterness is by using something like nuka. So that's rice bran, or sometimes they use wood ash. And so occasionally, if the takenoko is really fresh or there's a few different species, you can sometimes avoid this step. But generally, you would soak it in that nuka for a little while. And then my favorite way of cooking bamboo shoots, which is a very traditional way, is takenoko gohan. So takenoko just means bamboo child. So that's the bamboo shoot. And gohan means rice. So it's a very traditional way of cooking seasonal things in Japan. It's a cooked rice dish. So a little bit of sake. So my favorite is just sake and shoyu, soy sauce, and then the takenoko cooked in a donabe. It's so delicious with just with rice. And then on top, a typical thing that you would add is sansho. So for people that don't know what that is, that's a relative of Sichuan. And at this time of year, those new green leaves have just come up. And so it's called kinome, which is just the fresh young leaf on top. And that is citrusy. It has a slight spice. It's completely delicious. And so that's a very beautiful pairing, and it looks so gorgeous. So you put that on top of your takenoko gohan.
That's delicious. Awesome. I remember when I talked to Winifred Bird, who wrote Eating Wild Japan, she talked about going to a Kyoto restaurant specializing in bamboo and had 10 courses of bamboo dishes. Yeah, I just can't imagine that many different dishes, but
you can just
more versatile than you realize, right?
Oh, completely. And that's one thing that when you're a forager, you learn very well, is you are able to just substitute your wild ingredients in any way. So that's one thing that I've become very good at, is finding ways to use what you have rather than seeking something that you don't have. So you can use takenoko in any way that you would use a normal vegetable. You can always use it in a way that you would use something like a tofu. And so it's very versatile, but I think that pretty much everything is versatile if you utilize it.
When I saw you at MinkaCon, I remember you talking about how versatile and basically how safe mushrooms are. There's so many different kinds of mushrooms, right?
Yes. So it's safe if you know what it is. So it's the same with any plant. And mushrooms have had a really bad rap generally, but it is just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, foraging plants. So the first thing that I teach people is, if you don't know, if in doubt, throw it out. There is no way to safely forage unless you are 100% sure on identification. So that goes for mushrooms and plants. In general, people are very wary of mushrooms, especially outside of Japan. People are scared of touching them. But interestingly, there is only one species across the world where there are so many species. There is one species which is suspected of being dangerous to touch, And even that is contentious amongst scientists and foragers. So they don't actually know if it actually is. It's the Kaientake, which is in Japan. But basically, you can touch all mushrooms, just don't eat them. There are many plants that you cannot touch. So the thing that I try and do is just improve education about mushrooms and say that you should not be scared of mushrooms. You should allow yourself to engage with mushrooms and not be fearful of them. However, never eat anything that you don't know what it is. And I always say it's important to learn to forage sustainably, because that's a really important part of picking from the land, is not depleting the resources so that you can allow others to enjoy what you're picking for a long time. And also the ecosystem can be very negatively affected if you pick everything, especially with plants, actually.
Absolutely. Here we have one of your two dogs. Is this Bobo or
Apollo? Bobo. This is Bobo.
And Bobo, is Bobo and Apollo, are they good foragers?
They are excellent foragers. They are the most wonderful dogs. They're both incredible climbers. So the little one that's on screen, Bobo, she's only 2 kilos. She is so fit and healthy. She can climb for 10, 15 miles. The mountains, like I said, near me are completely sheer. There's no paths. It's a death wish to go up there. But I go up there with them and they are incredible climbers. I actually noticed something very interesting. And so the small dog, we found her in Korea 3 years ago, and she'd been living, homeless and wild. And last autumn, when I climbed up to the top to try and look for mushrooms, because there's only 2 species for the most of the forest, but on the top layer, there are a few more. And I noticed Bobo eating something, and I obviously was a bit concerned. And then I realized she was eating gumi berries. So this is a forageable berry. It's a berry that's eaten a little bit in Japan, but they have it in Korea too. And it's edible. And so she doesn't eat weird things. Neither of my dogs eat weird things, but she clearly had eaten these berries before. And so she was eating them. And then my other dog, who doesn't normally eat any fruits, he's a very picky eater, even though he was a street dog in Greece, he watched her. And so then he was eating them too. And I found that so interesting that they were able to realize that these, of all the berries, many of the berries are not edible, but these are. So that was a very interesting observation.
Yeah, you can learn things from your dogs too.
Yeah, well, that I found the gummy berry spot.
That's awesome. I think I showed some of the other mushrooms. So there's a beautiful big mushroom, your dog found.
Yes, that's a parasol mushroom. This mushroom is called a parasol mushroom. In Japanese, it's also called an umbrella mushroom. Completely delicious, found around the world. My favorite way to cook this is just to bread or tonkatsu or fry the whole of the top. So sometimes they can grow as big as this. So you can make them into burgers. You can enjoy them as a katsu, like a tonkatsu or a schnitzel. It's a completely delicious mushroom.
I love that. I love how mushrooms are such a great alternative to meat. Yeah. It's like nature's kind of hearty, savory taste. And then here you've got plum, right? Is that ume?
Yes.
So pickle into juice or ume wine, I guess alcohol you can make, or jam. What do you do with the ume plum?
So many different things. But also all the traditional things that you mentioned, the pickled plums, the umeshu, which is the liquor. What else? One of my favorite things that I've ever made was a ketchup that I made from the ume. That was absolutely delicious. They're not an ingredient that I had in the UK. They are actually technically more of an apricot, which is interesting. They're not like a normal plum. In the UK, there are so many different species of plums, but they are a different species, which is why they're not edible raw. You have to cook them. Whereas other plums, you can just kind of eat. But I've done a lot of experimentation with plums before, so I use them in many ways. But hot sauces, fermented sauces, they're amazing.
Oh, that's a good way. Yeah, I learned that you can't eat ume plums directly from the tree that's in our house, and I had the worst stomach ache. This one I don't recognize. What are we looking at?
Oh, so this is one of my favorites. This is the Yabu Kanzo. So this is the orange daylily. It's also known as the ditch lily. This is completely delicious. My favorite way is just to pan fry the unopened flower buds, but you can also eat the green shoots as they come up in spring. One thing to note is it should be cooked and not to eat too much. So whenever you're trying a new wild food, you should always try a tiny bit and kind of build tolerance. Many of these things your body hasn't eaten before and can be very sensitive to. These are so delicious, but I did overeat them one time and I did give myself a bad belly. But they're so unbelievably delicious. And I should have known better.
I had that experience one time. I was driving through a rural area and I just stopped at a local stand and she was selling sansai tempura. Mm. And when I ate it, half my mouth went numb. And I told her, I said, is your mouth supposed to be numb? And she's like, you should probably stop eating it.
Yeah.
You haven't built up a tolerance, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good advice. And then I think I showed this, but I'm not sure what this is.
So this is taranome, which is the angelica shoots at the top of a very long branch. Normally it's a very spiky tree. This is called the king of the sansai, or the king of the wild vegetables. That's its nickname. And it's traditionally tempura'd, so battered. That's the way that people typically enjoy it. They're quite difficult to get. There aren't many in my village and they're very spiky.
Then here, a different kind of mushroom, is it?
Yes. So this is a very niche mushroom that people in Japan don't know really, but this is called the Murasaki Shimeji. So Murasaki, purple, Shimeji, but Ura means upside down. So it's the other side of the mushroom is actually very brown looking. So I found these growing in my forest. There aren't actually lots of mushrooms growing in my forest compared to other places because of the two species being a monoculture. But I was completely thrilled to find these beautiful mushrooms. And then when I did some research, I found out they're edible and they're very, very good. They're very similar to a wood bluet or a field bluet, which is a common wild mushroom across the world. But it's particularly famous in French cuisine. It's called a pied bleu. So the French obviously love mushrooms and have a huge culture of eating mushrooms. So they look quite similar. They're nowhere related, but the taste and the look is somewhat similar.
That's awesome. You have so many more wonderful examples. But I also wanted to touch on the 72 micro seasons. But also you're using lots of wild things for dyeing, natural dyes. Yes. What are we looking at here? It makes such a beautiful blue color.
This is so gorgeous. So this plant is called kusagi, which means stinky plant. It's the Harley Quinn glory bower. And it's a beautiful, beautiful dye. It looks very similar to natural indigo, which hasn't been fermented. So I grew indigo this year or last year as well. It's a slightly different blue to the raw indigo, but completely beautiful. And that's it's just heated up, so you haven't added anything else to create that color. There's no mordant. So sometimes when you're using dyeing, people use various mordants, sometimes metals, to get a reaction. But this is just raw silk and then the kusagi berries.
I love it. And then you've got this pink dye.
Oh, that's the same. That's the same.
Oh, is it?
And so that's where the kusagi berries are inside.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's pink on the outside, blue inside.
Yeah, wow. It's an incredible blue.
And then you did an event at a local place talking about natural dyes. What kind of dye are we looking at here?
So these are all mushroom dyes that I've done with various species of mushroom, all on reclaimed silk. So you can see that there's a huge range, even a light blue, which is very difficult. So we obviously have indigo and we have the kusagi berries, but blue colors are not that easy to come about. But yeah, I like to experiment with mushrooms.
Yeah, interesting. I've seen fermented persimmon dye, natural dye, which is very similar color to that. And I didn't realize you were using mushrooms. Amazing.
Yes, the fermented kaki dye is very important in Japanese culture. I want to make some this year, but all of this was done without a fermentation element, which is pretty incredible that you can get that depth of colors. I've got them all in front of me, and they don't seem to have faded. When you're doing natural dye, sometimes it's not very color fast, or the colors evolve over time, but I've been really surprised at how well they've seemed to have held for now.
Wow, that's awesome. You did workshops locally making this tea. What are you making the tea from?
Yeah, so I hold workshops occasionally. I don't do them all the time. I try to focus on education of younger people. So I sometimes have university students come. I like teaching, but I'm not a full-time teacher. I like to teach through storytelling, as that's my main passion. So that was actually using kuzu or kudzu, as the Western world call it. So kudzu was brought over to America, and it's known as the vine that ate the South. So it's hugely invasive. It's actually destroyed the natural habitat of a huge amount of America in the South. But you can make such delicious things from the flowers. So this is a kind of lemonade that I made from steeping the flowers. It tastes like grape flavor. It tastes like grape flavor in Japan. So grapes in Japan have such a gorgeous flavor that they don't really have in America or in the UK. But so I use that, and I use the flowers to make things like jelly. But interestingly, the root of the kuzu or kudzu vine is really prized in Japan. So an area very close to me is famous, and they make noodles out of it, but it's not utilized at all in America. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I was hearing from locals about rebringing that traditional technique back, because kudu, like bamboo, if you're not using it, it becomes invasive. It goes everywhere. But in having these references to actually using it for food and making noodles, making things, I had no idea about the flowers becoming this beautiful pink tea. How lovely.
And it's so interesting. So many of these invasive plants, as they're called, which have been taken out of their natural habitats, they're actually highly medicinal. The problem is, when we made the world global and we put things in the place where they have no competitors. But it's the same with itadori, Japanese knotweed. That, if you have it in your house in the UK, you can't sell your house. You can't even get a mortgage. So it's very damaging to the landscape in the UK. But of course, Japanese knotweed, like kudzu or kudzu, is home in Japan, and it's highly medicinal and edible and delicious. So I think it's really important for people to try and learn their invasive species, and if they're edible, and eat them. That's one of the things that I teach most in the UK, is eat your weeds rather than pulling them up and throwing them, sometimes even in trash bags.
Awesome. I love that. I love when we do composting and you get treasures out of the compost. And it's the same idea, right? Like, you're getting things you can eat, which maybe some people think is a weed, but if it has, you know, nutritional value or medicinal value, why just throw it away? What a waste, right?
Yeah. So many of these plants that people overlook are full of nutritional value and have so much higher nutritional content than what we buy in the supermarkets. So many people are sitting on a huge resource, a huge variety of delicious things that people can eat that are often overlooked.
Absolutely. I remember when I met you at Minka Khan and heard your great talk talking about the micro seasons, and you said you had to rush back home to document that basically it takes over your life. Like every 2 weeks, you have a different micro season. Is that right?
It's every 5 days. So oh, it's wow. even 4 to 5 days. One thing that I found when I began documenting the micro seasons is there's just so much to see and so much to enjoy. And as I film everything, edit everything, I write all the poetry myself, it's quite a full-on project. And so I did one whole year of following all the micro seasons, but then I had so many people who sent me such wonderful messages from all around the world. And I actually had people kind of begging me to continue. So I have been continuing them. So I was up late last night finishing a micro season, but it's just been such a wonderful way to connect with this new landscape that I'm a part of and actually learn so much. It's given me a focus that's much broader than just foraging. The level of things, well, the level of research that I've had to do when I've come across things, in particular insects and birds, I've learned so much and become so connected to the rhythm of the passage of time here. It's been so wonderful. And as you can see, I love not just highlighting the classic seasonal things in Japan. Of course, everyone knows the cherry blossom. Of course, everyone knows the maple leaves. People know the azaleas. People know the hydrangeas. My joy is really in highlighting things that are overlooked. And so, for example, this beautiful moth that I discovered over winters, so it doesn't die off. So I was seeing these moths and their eyes are so iridescent. Look at that beautiful, it's almost like a raindrop. So that's part of the message that I've tried to instill through the micro seasons. It's not just appreciating the obvious things, but understanding all the elements within a biosphere, that everything plays a role and it all has equal importance, provided it's supposed to be there in the first place. Obviously with invasive species, it's slightly different, but I think an appreciation of everything rather than, I think in Japan, there can be a tendency sometimes to focus on, for example, like a flower park, where there's just one species of flowers, and yes, it's incredibly beautiful, but actually it's not a healthy ecosystem. Yes, there's lots of bees, but really it would be better if there were multiple species all growing together.
Are you following a book? How are you able to track these micro seasons? Where does this knowledge come from? Are you asking local people as well?
So the micro seasons originally came from China many years ago. I think that they started around 100 CE in China. And then in the 6th century, they were brought over via a Korean priest. That was just the beginnings of the micro seasons. But back then, it was all related to the Chinese ecosystem. And so in 1685, they sent the first state astronomer around to make them universally Japanese. So paying attention to the particular cultural things, but also the seasonal elements within Japan, and actually building on a system of seasonality that has existed since the beginning of the Japanese people. So many of the motifs that we see represented in art and poetry have existed at least since the 8th, 9th, 10th century. So you see them referenced in the first body of work, the Manyoshu. You can see though the thread of the micro seasons beginning there and then continuing. So this system was practiced until the Meiji Restoration, Reformation. So it was actually a way of tracking time up until 1873. So many people used to use this calendar and be very connected to it, but it has largely been forgotten. When I meet people, older people, I would say about 20% of the people that I meet that are kind of farmer type people know about it. Maybe slightly more, But generally across Japan, many people don't actually know about it. And so I've had so many messages from Japanese people who've really enjoyed learning about the micro seasons, because so many things are linked. It's like a cultural basis for many things that the Japanese still do, but there has been a big fracture actually, because the Japanese, like I say, they love seasonality. They have all of these motifs. They are so connected to the seasons in so many ways through the way that they eat, the shun, eating seasonally, eating things at the best time, through the poetry, through art and culture, through all of these things. But actually, there's been a big disconnect in people actually really being connected to nature. And that's all largely happened since World War II. And so it's very interesting to see what has persisted, but what has also been forgotten. So that's one thing I'm trying to hopefully do, is kind of bridge that gap between a rich, completely inspiring culture linked to nature, but actually quite a loss of knowledge. I see it all the time when people come for workshops, Japanese people. An example that I'll use is, so yomogi, which is mugwort. So this Artemisia plant was used in many cultures. It was used in the UK, for instance, but right now no one uses it. It's been completely forgotten. It grows everywhere, but people don't know what it is. In Japan, yomogi is eaten. It's used as tea. People know of it. And so at my Michi no Eki, my roadside station, mochi made from yomogi are sold. Everyone that came to my house from a workshop had brought a box of these mochi. I watched them eat it. They were all saying, oh, this yomogi mochi is delicious. And so then we're in the field and I said, does anyone know what this plant is? Everyone picks up the plant. I said, have a look, have a smell, crush a bit. No one of that group of 10 Japanese people knew what that plant was, but they had all eaten it. And it's the same with tea. We have so many wild tea bushes everywhere. So that's Camellia sinensis. That's the tea. That's black tea, white tea, matcha, green tea. It's all the same species. And I can ask people, does anyone know what this tree is, this leaf is? I have never yet met someone that knows what it is, but I have watched them all drink the tea. And so there's a huge disconnect, because obviously Japanese love food, they love the sansai, they love the idea of foraging, but so many people are completely disconnected from the actual plants. And so I think that's really sad.
That reminds me so much of like Jamie Oliver, when he would take vegetables into schools and ask kids, what is this? And they can't even recognize like an eggplant or a cucumber. This is so educational, so informative, and it connects to people's culture and past that they're losing. That as a young person, you're able to bring back this knowledge and understanding. I love it. I love yomogi mochi. That's my favorite as well. But I'm not sure I could recognize the plant either. So
you can have to come here, JJ.
I would love to do a forest walk with you. I would learn so much. Absolutely.
Yeah. So much of what I am trying to do is combine learning as much as possible from the village ancestors. So like Umemoto-san, she has a really rich knowledge in certain plants, very typical Japanese sansai, but she doesn't have knowledge on what she considers weeds. So there's a very interesting push and pull. She really hates weeds. So she's a formidable farmer. She's completely brilliant at farming. She's been farming for 70 years, but her way of farming is scorched soil. They're not a single weed. There's neat rows, and she spends all day weeding and squishes all the bugs. So I have a more kind of modern view. I do no-dig farming. I am trying to create an ecosystem with companion planting. I'm trying to encourage native wildflowers where possible. And because of that, I've had less bugs, actually, because doing that companion planting really helps. But it's a very difficult kind of negotiation, because Umemoto-san hates weeds. So she comes to my garden and weeds for me. because she thinks that weeds are bad. She actually believes that the mountain gods like scorched earth. That scorched earth is cleanliness, and that's considered good, and in a kind of religious way. So I've learned so much from Umemoto-san, and especially when it comes to, you know, Japanese cultural things. Many of these practices that Japanese don't do anymore, she does them all. And so I've learned so many things from her, and even just particular, very localized foraging. So there's a plant called the Japanese big-leafed magnolia. So it's very large leaves. It's called the honoki, and the leaves are called the honoha. And we make these mochi from these big leaves, and then you tie them together. I think you showed one of the other photos with them in. And that's a traditional practice in Higashiyoshino, where I live. And people don't do this anymore, but the leaves are antibacterial, so it's really good as a kind of way of preserving, and obviously zero waste packaging. And so I'm so blessed to be able to learn about this very localized tradition, and hopefully put some efforts into preserving it.
I love this. I love this. I wish leaf packaging was more common. Sometimes you'll see it in a supermarket, like if it's sakura mochi, and they pickle the leaves so that you can eat the leaf as well. But then they'll package that in plastic, and you're like, why?
I want to do a nationwide campaign. My most hated thing that you get when you have the bento is the little bit of green plastic grass that they have. And I hate that. They do it at my local Michino Eki, so I want to maybe start there and see if there's a way that I can speak to the government to kind of get that stopped. That is such a useless thing. Absolutely. And like you say, there are so many forms of organic packaging. Yes. Something that I do all the time is using native leaves in the UK. So when I had an event there, I was inspired by what they do with the oak leaves and the sakura leaves. And so there's a linden leaf. It's an edible leaf. So I use those. I made yomogi mochi and put them on the linden leaves. But I think with the reason that I hate the green piece of grass is it's used as a decorative element. So it doesn't actually have a function. And so it's completely useless. And every time I see that, I'm just enraged. But I think that the Japanese have an issue with their love of packaging and the love of everything being so perfect. And so I hope that gradually the obsession with perfection, especially when it comes to vegetables and fruits and pesticides, I hope that that can be replaced with a more wabi-sabi view on appearance.
Absolutely. And it would be added value if you had a real shiso leaf instead of the plastic grass. Or I'm sure you have loads of alternatives, even, you know, bok choy or any kind of edible leaf. Why not? It would add value to the bento, right? You would have more nutrition and healthy alternative, right?
Exactly. Whenever I cook anything, I try and use a leaf. So whether it's now I don't have access to banana leaves, but whenever I steam dumplings, I just use cabbage or lettuce on the bottom, and then you can wrap it up and it's delicious. You don't have to use a piece of baking paper. Sometimes when you're baking cakes, there might be a reason why you have to, but I think generally if you don't have to, there are alternatives.
Absolutely. There's a beautiful kind of, I call it tea leaf, because in Hawaii, where I grew up, it's the same leaf that the Hawaiians always used for plates or wrapping food or even tea leaf skirts. But we have it in my garden. So I always think it's here, like we could use this as plates or wrapping or for a variety of things. We do have so many wonderful natural alternatives, right?
Definitely.
Awesome. So we've talked about 72 micro seasons. One thing, when I was first introduced to the micro seasons was when I went to a doctor and I had a cold and he recommended some herbal medicine and he consulted this big book of micro seasons. That was my first introduction.
Wow,
and he was talking about, do you often feel a bit run down this time of year? It might be this flower, it might be this tree, it might be this insect. And so he was a real believer. I love that historical, traditional, cultural reference to what's happening around us.
Yeah, I think that you can use the micro seasons as a lens of seeing, I guess, what Japan used to be like and what things still persist. I think a really interesting thing that I learned about that I practice. So you know how Japan has the five seku, which are the five festivals that are still celebrated every year. The first one, which is the Nanakusa one, so Nanakusa seven weeds. So this is a traditional rice porridge that is traditionally eaten on that day. The 7th of January, it's a tradition that was taken from China, but people still eat that. But now people go to the supermarket and there's a pre-packaged set with the seven herbs in there. Well, it's actually five herbs and then turnip and kind of daikon-y, radishy thing. But that tradition has existed since the 9th century. And it shows you how important foraging and these wild herbs are to Japanese culture. But I guess, like I said before, there has been a bit of a disconnect. So not many people go out. But I went out with Umemoto-san the past 2 years. It's actually very hard to find those herbs where I live, as I mentioned, due to the monoculture. But I have been able, I spent all day walking and I was able to pick the five herbs. And so I made the Nanakusa Gayu, the rice porridge. It was very fun.
That's awesome. Are those things that you could replicate in your farm? Like, could you make a section that you could grow the five herbs?
Yes.
Is that possible?
Yes. So I've tried. So I have a hatake, like a fenced off farm area. I've tried introducing wild plants, naturalized or native plants, to my overall garden. It has not gone well because we have so many wild beasts. So I was trying not to plant them in my vegetable garden because I wanted to have it more wild. But I've had so many very sad break-ins destruction from the animals. I try so hard not to take it personally because obviously the animals have to eat too. But I did spend quite a long time moving some things recently, and actually everything that I spent two whole days sculpting my garden and everything got eaten, sadly. And so what my vision really was to have a medicinal garden at the back of my house, which faces the river. And I wanted it not to be in the fenced area because I wanted it to look more wild and how it would be. But I have discovered that it is completely impossible, unfortunately, where I live. And so I'm this year going to have to kind of mix it within my garden. And I was doing that a little bit, but my vision of having this open medicinal garden has not been able to manifest.
What is it? Is it the badger, the anaguma? Is it the inoshishi? Is it all of them? Do you know what animal it is?
All of them apart from the inoshishi. So we don't really have many wild boar around here, but we have many deer, shika. We have many hakubishin, which is a palm civet. We have many araiguma, which is a raccoon. I think we have a lot of little guys, little mousy people too. Usagi, rabbits, no usagi, like a hare. But I love the animals. And so my dream is to have enough that we could all share together. But I think to establish that kind of thing, I would have to put fences up to allow the plants to at least get strong enough to sustain being eaten. But Umemoto-san hates the animals. She catches them.
It's a difficult balance, isn't it? I went and visited Nagano Naturally, Heather Fukase's beautiful organic farm. And she doesn't have fencing either. And she says sometimes she'll have this beautiful row of pumpkins that are just ready for harvest. She'll think, I'll harvest them tomorrow. She comes back and each pumpkin has one bite out of it from the monkeys. And she's like, I'm happy to share, but come on, you know?
Yeah, I think we don't really have many monkeys. And so monkeys can get over fences anyway. But I think it's all about where you're situated. So we're situated, I am in the mountain. My garden is the mountain. So nothing can survive here. Whereas people that are more in the village, everyone has flowers outside their house and things. Their vegetables are fenced, but nothing can grow that is juicy and green near me that is not deer resistant. I mean, they even eat things that are technically deer resistant here. So they're clearly very hungry.
Yeah, it's a big problem all over Japan. There's an overpopulation of deer and boar. Do you have bears where you are?
So there's been a lot of talk of bears. I've seen bear scat, fresh bear scat a few times. I really feel like it's all due to a misbalance that humans have caused.
Absolutely.
And so Higashiyoshino, where I live, is famous for being the place where the last wolf was. So there's all this wolf mythology. But I think that when they eradicated the wolf, there was a lot of damage done. This isn't something that's talked about in my village. This is probably a very controversial thing, but from doing a bit of research myself, this is all completely human caused.
Yeah.
There was a really kind of nationwide campaign to kind of, eradicate wolves, get rid of wolves, not even to get rid of them, but to deplete the population. But it had a very catastrophic effect, I think, on the whole chain of things. And also what Japan did to the forests, where they cut down all of the traditional old growth forests and just replaced it with two species of trees. That has had a really negative effect on all of their ecosystem and the animals within those ecosystems, because before you would have a huge variety of trees, many of them broadleaf, producing nuts, which sustain the lower bits of the food chain. And now there's only cedar and cypress. And so there's no nuts for those smaller animals to eat. And so it all has had an effect, which is very sad. But now I'm here, I'm thinking, okay, what small measures can I take to try and improve this? And then I'm thinking long-term, what can I do to make a difference? Working within the current systems, working together with my neighbors, but to try and make it better, because there is a problem and humans have caused it.
Absolutely. And I love how both you and your partner Felix are both helping with the problem. His wooden designs using the wood from the forest, which is thinned in the local area, which is such a necessity with this monocrop, too many of one kind of tree, right?
Well, particularly in all of these cedar forests and cypress forests, but particularly in our area, it's so steep. So there was a time when this wood was incredibly valuable. And so this village was prospering, but it's been on a steady decline since the mid-1960s. So this industry, I mean, it's a wonderful industry steeped in culture. There is all this wood that needs to be used. But to get this wood, helicopters have to be used. That's how steep it is. It's incredibly, it's a treacherous job, but very expensive. And so only large bits of wood are worth money, because you can make better things from them. But that would have taken tens and up to 100 years to grow. And so lots of these forests, which are completely human made, this whole area is all human made forest. But there are many forests that are no longer managed because it's not worth it. So those people don't have a job. The economy is negatively suffering. And so it's like, how can we find ways to use this wood, keep people in business, collaborate with local people, And also, I think in the long run, I hope to work together with Felix to reforest. So he will use the wood and work with the local people, and together we will plant native Nara species. That's the long-term goal, to try and come up with a long-term solution to help the village and help the people and benefit the environment.
Absolutely. And you'll help putting food back in the forest by dealing with bears coming into town or animals coming into to find food where the forest has been depleted, right? So there's so many positive knock-on effects to all the work you're doing. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I would love to come visit you and learn from, walk around with you and learn from you. I really wish you all the best and really excited to see what projects you have coming up.
Thank you so much for having me, and you are welcome anytime.
I can't wait. If people want to find your work and support you, where can they go, Emily?
So at the moment, I'm most active on Instagram. So my handle is @down2forage. I also am posting a little bit on YouTube and on TikTok. But I am working on a book at the moment. So more about that will come out soon. Also working on a longer piece of film. Lots of different things in the pipeline.
I love it. I would love to see a Netflix documentary about you and Felix. Wouldn't that be lovely?
That would be sweet. Yes. I think NHK want to come back.
Yeah. NHK was lovely too. But also a book that, you know, that makes so much sense from all your beautiful photos and all your knowledge from foraging and covering the micro seasons. Can't wait for that.
Thank you.
I'll put all the links below, of course, so people can find it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. All right, everyone. See you next time. Take care.
Bye.